So today is the 10th of March, 2009.
Yeah, you're starting now.
So it's the 10th of March, 2009, and I'm speaking to, who am I speaking to?
Nancy Fitzgerald, RSCJ.
And where were you born, what year were you born, Nancy, and where were you born? Yeah, we've got to get into, we've got to do a, you don't have, you should see her face, everybody.
Well, I'll give you 20 years younger than I am. Mm. No, I was born in 1930.
Mm. You're looking good.
Yeah, I know.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Kew in Melbourne.
And can you talk a bit about how that environment was like growing up?
Well, there were 10 children in our family, 5 boys and 5 girls. Very Catholic, very happy.
Yeah. What sort of class did you come from? Middle class?
Middle, yes. My father was a journalist. We just went to the local primary school until secondary, and then we went to, I went to Sacre Coeur. That's our school in Melbourne.
See what happens when you start recording every sound. I'll notice that everyone was... So let's go on again. What school did you go to?
Sacre Coeur. That's our school in Melbourne. My aunt had entered that order, and I was called after her.
What was that school like for you?
Great. Lovely school.
What did you enjoy at school?
Oh, everything. I was very happy. Yeah.
And... keeping your answers nice and short. And I know you've got to go in 5
minutes. It's all right. No, I'm joking. Now, nearly.
So, where did you first start sort of feeling that you might be, you know, joining the convent?
Well, when I was a little child, from about 5 up, if anybody asked me what I was going to be when I grew up, I would say a nurse or a nun, but not a teacher. Don't know what brought that on, but there you are. Then later on, my elder sister entered, and I think that brought it closer to me. And then I decided I'd like to enter also.
Mm. Can you just describe what the nuns wore when you were at school? What was their habit?
It was the peasant's costume of 17th century France, no, perhaps 18th century France, because the order was founded during the time of the French Revolution, and if you looked remotely like a religious of any kind, your head would roll. So they looked like an ordinary person of the lower class, and they were called Madame instead of sister or mother, because that was Mrs. So it was Madame Barra, because if you were sister, you'd be in the Bastille and gone. And people got the idea, because of the Madame, that we were grand Madames, because Madeleine Sophie did educate the aristocracy. She was terribly well educated herself. Just by coincidence of her, the fact that her brother was a teacher and then a priest, and he, from the age of 7, educated her with what he taught his students. So she had the full gamut, and it paid off. Well, she ran these schools for the aristocracy who'd been displaced and shoved out, but they were still quite wealthy. But every school that she had to run a school for the children of the neighbourhood who couldn't afford education. And that was the policy. They had their own school. That school funded a school for the children in the area, the poorer children. And they learned what would get them positions in life. You know, not... for the children there, they wouldn't have learned the same things as they did in the boarding school, where Madeleine Sophie insisted they learn everything that men would learn, all the sciences, history, languages, not just women's things. More the young one did that, they dressmaking and cooking and everything else that would get them positions in life, and reading and writing.
So that was quite radical foundations.
Absolutely, yes.
So are you saying they are the foundations that have influenced the Sacred Heart movement?
Yes, yes. The poor have always had a very high priority. It didn't work out here because the parish schools, they did initially at the school I was at, to have a little school in the grounds, but there was a parish school soon afterwards, and the children then, it was better for them to go to the parish school and be part of the parish. So the parish schools did what we tried to do where we were at the beginning.
So that was in Kew?
No, this was it. It was Glen Iris, Burke Road. Yes, I had to take a tram road.
Okay, so let's just connect that there. So you're talking about when you entered the convent?
That's when I was at school.
Oh, at school, sorry. Mm, okay, yeah. So you're describing the type of school you were at.
Yes, and the type of order that it is.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you asked about the habit that brought that on.
Yes, that's great. I love that. So what were some of the names of the nuns at your school? And maybe just, I know, I'm just interested now.
Yes. Well, Reverend Mother Salomon was a very well-known one, and she'd been the provincial here for something like 29 years, because in those days, if you became a provincial, you didn't ever change, you stated. Now they have a term of office, and that's it. She had just died when I entered, but Mother Kirby was very well-known. She was the Mistress General, that was the principal of the school. Teresa Cohen was the superior. They moved around our convents in Australia and New Zealand and were very well known. There were lots of others. We used our surname, as I said in the beginning, we never took a religious name. We used our surnames always. Because that goes back to the foundation, when you wouldn't have been Sister Madeleine, she was Madame Barra. That was her surname.
And was that the same for you? Were you Sister Fitzgerald?
Yes, yes.
Sister McMahon.
Yes, we all had our surnames and still do, but now it's much more, we call ourselves by our own names. We often didn't know each other's first names because we had a rule of silence and you didn't communicate except at recreation, very formally.
Yes, so that's, I'll explore some of that because I find that, I think that's very interesting, that impact what it must have had at some point, like for some years.
Yes.
But we'll get there. So you were influenced by your sister.
Yes.
So what year did you become a novice, is that correct?
Yes, postulant first. That was the beginning of 1948.
So you'd grown up, you saw the war?
Yes, yes.
Anything, would you like to talk about any impact of the war?
Well, three of my brothers were in the forces, my elder brothers, the oldest, first three boys. And we said the rosary in our house every day, every night, and not one hair of their heads was touched. And my mother put that down to the rosaries we said every night for them. One was up in Borneo, Tarakan, where the Japanese were bombing constantly. My eldest brother was in Darwin at the time of the invasion there. The other one didn't leave Australia or wasn't involved in the war. He was up at the Atherton Tablelands. They were up there.
Could you tell me their names?
Brian was the eldest. Paul was the next. He's an artist in Melbourne, quite well known. And Jerry was the next one.
And your sister that entered Sacred Heart?
Yes, yes.
Her name?
Marita.
And is Marita still alive?
Yes, yes. She's in Melbourne. She's 4 years older than I am. And rather poorly in health, but...
I'm just going to shut that door because I can hear them talking.
Can you?
Yes. Sorry.
Would it pick that up?
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
And rather than have a bit of clouded sound,
yes.
We need to hear your voice, you know.
Okay.
So I'm sorry.
That's all right, I don't mind.
We'll sweat it out. Okay.
Just thinking if there's somewhere else we can go.
No, we're fine here.
Okay.
That's okay. If you're fine?
Yes. I could come to a totally quiet place. That's downstairs in my room, in a cave.
And we might get some echo.
No, you wouldn't.
Oh, okay.
Or else we could go around to the community room and.
If you're okay, are you okay here?
I'm fine.
All right,
it could be noisy anywhere up here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay, so can you talk about the lead up to you becoming a postulant, like what you were experiencing spiritually, or?
Well, all I know that I wanted to enter, the sooner the better. My father wanted me to go on with my studies. Education was very important to him. But I didn't want to, as I said, be a teacher. And I wanted to be that we had two things in our order. We had the choir nuns who said choir and were the teachers, or other things in the house, but they said choir, or they were what was called coadjutrix sisters. They took the same vows and it was the same religious life, only they didn't teach. They ran the household and all the domestic side of the house, and to me it was much more a contemplative order, aspect of the order, and that's what attracted me, as it had my sister. So much to my father's disappointment, probably a few people, I didn't continue right through to matriculation. I left after intermediate and had to stay home for a year, so I entered after that year into the and became what they call the sisters. The others were called mother, and I just loved it, but I couldn't wait to enter. And I just loved the life and everything about it. People have horrific stories of the noviceship and what they went through. I was as happy as a lark and loved it. And then when the Vatican came along and changed the order, I was devastated, because it said there's no, can't be that division in the orders anymore. They have to be one. And I didn't like the idea of it all.
So what do you mean by that? You mean going from a contemplative to an apostolic?
Yes.
Just talk a little bit about that, just describe that a bit more, about that process.
Well, what happened was Vatican II cut out that division in an order, that two aspects of an order, because in some orders I think they call them lay sisters and they didn't take the same vows. We were called coadjutrix sisters, we took the same vows. The choir nuns, as they were called, took a vow for the education of youth, or education particularly of youth, but any kind of education. So after that, to kind of fit in, I realised I'd have to do something. So I did teacher training and taught in the school, and then I did a diploma of pastoral care. And then when I became the principal at Sadler, I did the Bachelor of Education, because I thought the teachers have got to do this and I can't ask them to do it if I'm not doing it myself. So I did it, and then several of the teachers did it too. And so then I went on to do a Master's and I stopped at that. But I was involved in the school for about 20 years.
That's a long time.
It didn't seem all that long. I taught for 6 years down at Sacred Coeur in the primary school, and then I was 13 years at Sadler. That's 19. I think 1 year I had a sabbatical and I did the Assumption Institute course down at Rosanna. That was a wonderful course. It was a spirituality year, so I suppose I can't count that year.
We'll get back to that. Can I take you back to your contemplative life?
Yeah.
And what could you describe to me how you spent your time?
Well, you got up at 5:15 and were involved in all the works of the house. There was so much to do in a big school. There was reception. At some places I was on the reception, and that could be busy and complicated, especially at Rose Bay. Then there's the sacristy. You looked after the chapel and the altar and the masses. Then there was the kitchen. That was a heavy load because there were boarders at Rose Bay, certainly. I was there for 17 years. And there was the dining room, which was big and busy. Bourke Road phased out boarders, and Rose Bay never did. There was a study done to look at the need, and Victoria didn't need a boarding school. New South Wales did. There was the infirmary, a very big infirmary at Rose Bay. I spent a lot of time there looking after the old sisters because we nursed them till they died. We never went out. The dentist came when I entered, and I found some old garments in the infirmary, and I said to the other infirmarian, what are these for? She said they were the doctor's robes for operations. We were that enclosed at one stage. But it had to come that we became apostolic to perform our work properly.
How did you find the enclosure, like emotionally?
Oh, I didn't care. When you entered, you knew you'd never go home again. You couldn't see your parents even if they were dying. But you took that step, and it was just par for the course. And I never minded. But when a change came, my sister went home and nursed our mother for nearly 3 years before she died. So that was great.
Mm. With the prayer, how important was prayer to you? It obviously took up a lot of your time.
Well, we had meditation in the morning, 40 minutes. Then we had a quarter of an hour about midday that time. And then half an hour in the afternoon in the chapel. Then we had spiritual reading for half an hour during the day. It was read aloud to us while we sewed or did something like that. And then we had night prayers at night. And there'd be extra things like adoration all day on Sunday where you, whenever you could, you went to the chapel to pray. But it was a very precious part of your day. But because you were engaged in work that didn't occupy your mind, you could be praying, you know, whenever you liked, when you could, you know, if it was something like ironing or folding clothes, or, you know, it was a contemplative life in my book.
And your prayers, was there an evolution, did they shift through that period?
Yes, you do change. We had, for instance, some meditation books. We'd prepare the meditation the night before, and it was all done out for you in points, you know, and then it'd give gospel scenes and things. And I went on for that for ages. And I got to the stage when I thought, I don't want to do it this way anymore. And then the thing came through that you could choose your own. And it just coincided with that beautifully. So I'd take the gospel or whatever. And you do change in what you like to do and how you like to do it. But it's just, I suppose, whether it's natural to change as you go. But the basic relationship is still there. So how it's expressed can vary.
So how was your mind through that period with that level of prayer and meditation? Were you at peace?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Was there any particular favourite periods of meditation?
I don't think so. I just liked it. Before I entered, I used to love to go to the church for visits. Our mother would always encourage us to go for a visit. And I used to just love going to the church and sitting there. We used to go to Mass in the morning at the Franciscans. We just lived a few doors away. And I just loved being there. And it's funny, my mother was cute. My older sister, Margot, she was very gregarious. She'd go down and she'd be chatting to everybody that she met and be late home with the messages and get into trouble. I'd go to the church and be just as long away. My mother never said boo. So,
and were there any favourite saints?
Oh, yes, I had lots. Saint Anthony, whom I took for confirmation, And Saint Therese of the Child Jesus, I'd have to say they were. But I loved lots of the saints. I used to read the lives of the saints. And
can you talk a bit about Saint Therese?
Saint Therese, oh, she was so beautiful. I don't know if you've ever read her life,
The
Life of a Soul. She was just overflowing with the love of God from go to woe, and in a contagious kind of a way. And you could see how it influenced her life and those around her. And in just the simplest things, it was love with whatever she did. And she said, that's all you need. To the extent that she heard when she was dying, one of the sisters outside saying, I don't know what we're going to write about Saint Therese, about Therese when she dies. She's got nothing to write about. And that's the impression she gave, you see, because she didn't do anything extraordinary. It was just her relationship with God that was full of love in everything she did. And she wanted to spread that message. And she said, after my death, I let forth a shower of roses. Well, after she died, all over the world, the devotion grew to her. She became patroness of the missions worldwide, this little unknown saint. And she's known worldwide. And her message is still going forward. So that's what God can do. And she made an impact on me.
And in what regard?
Well, that's, yes.
Inspiring.
Yes, life.
Or just living your life.
Yes.
Because you are quite cheeky, really. I'm wondering how you went.
Beg your pardon.
I don't know you. But, I mean, I can just imagine them all at St. Therese at a party.
Oh, don't talk about that.
We won't go there. Because I know those people very well.
Yes, they were great people. Oh, Carmel. And Shirley Barr.
Shirley.
You should get Shirley Barr.
I've photographed Shirley quite a bit. I am going to.
Don't miss out on Shirley Barr. She is a walking saint, that lady. She was the best thing God gave me there at St. Therese.
I'm just getting a feeling now during the documentary process, because you're all obviously contributing something kind of interesting, as well as the St. Therese experience, which is about reclaiming what the press said about Green Valley through your voices, really.
Oh, great.
That's really what it is.
Green Valley was the best place. Every one of our sisters who went to St. Therese, it was, I would say, their favourite place. The people there, I say, are the real people. They're not trying to hide things. They're not ashamed of things that go wrong in their lives. They're genuine people. And you can be at home with them. They're grateful. Very often you can find people who are given everything, but they want more. And they don't appreciate even what they've got. But it's not like that. Out in the Green Valley. Beautiful, genuine, holy people. Mind you, like everywhere, there are all sorts. And, you know, that's what you cope with wherever you go, because that's human nature. Everybody loved St. Therese and loved being there. And it was very sad when we didn't have the numbers to continue there, but I say, with all the falling away of the brothers and the sisters in the education system, it had to happen. The Catholics in Australia were the second-class citizens when they came. They were mostly Irish who had been displaced and owned. Well, not disowned, but everything was taken from them, except their education. They had the head schools. They kept on educating themselves. But they were, a lot of them, convicts. They were poor. But thanks to the brothers and sisters who came out in shoals and set the education system going, and the people like the Josephites, Mary MacKillop, the Catholics now are running their own universities. Now, where are these teachers going if the sisters and brothers have all still got the jobs? So God just took them away, because that job was done. There'll always be a place for religious life because it's the prophetic role in the church, going out to where the need is and bringing the word of God there into people's lives. It'll be different now. And you can see the Catholics are running their own education system. They're standing on a par with anybody in the country. So that work's been done. And how did I get onto that?
Well, we want to love those roles, see? You've got to get on a roll. That was great. See, okay. That's extraordinary grab.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. Because you're revealing parts of yourself and giving a bit of history as well at the same time. And you're passionate about it, and that comes
through. Well, that's why, though it was hard to move out of St. Therese, it's going on beautifully now. It is just gorgeous. We've been back on several occasions. We've been invited back. And last year, I think it might be the year before now, we went up for the liturgy they were having. And it was all on St. Therese in their courtyard. And it was the most beautiful liturgy that they put on, a prayer thing with illustrations and actions and prayers. And, oh, you couldn't find anything better or more Catholic or more lovely than that's what's happening there now. So that's very encouraging.
So what led you to, what was your lead up to Green Valley?
Oh, well, I'd been teaching in a school in Burke Road, Sacre Coeur, in the primary school. And we all had to have a renewal of some kind after Vatican II. So I went to, as I said, the Somerston Institute for a year. And after that, this job came up at St. Therese for a deputy principal. And I was asked, would I like to do it? And I said, oh, sure. So I did. And that's how I went there. Diana Hayes was the principal. I taught. And one day a week, I replaced her. Deputy principal to me didn't have the slightest connection with ever being principal. But then, of course, when she moved on, that was what you kind of expected to happen. So I did, and that's where Shirley Bartz came into her own for me, because she knew everything and everybody, and she's the most saintly lady. She wouldn't agree with that, but it's true.
Tell me about Shirley. What is Shirley?
Shirley is a mother. She's been there since the beginning. Her values are top class in everything. She loved those little children. And I remember one little boy. There was an Aboriginal family there. And she loved them, the mother Dell. And there was a little baby Jordan. And he was running around the courtyard one day, stark naked, not even two. She grabbed a camera. She couldn't resist getting little Jordan. She just loved him. She just loved them. And she was so wise. And if ever I had to make a decision about something or think up something and do something, I'd always check. I'd say, Shirl, what did you think if we do this and that? She'd say, wonderful, wonderful. You know, she made you feel so good and was so encouraging. I found it the great support, the greatest support, I would say.
What year did you head to St. Therese?
In 1983, and I was there till the end of 1995. It was 13 years.
So the community's kind of established then, isn't it? And probably
absolutely.
Changing its migration.
Yes, there were a lot of migrants coming in, a lot of migrants. In fact, looking at the assembled children for assembly, they're all types, all colours, you know, but they didn't know, there was no, you know, division, no racism, nothing. In fact, I remember when I first went, the cricket teams were called the Aussies and the Wogs, and Ted Lowen was out there presiding, and I said, Ted, that's a terrible thing to choose those names, Aussies and Wogs. He said, they chose it themselves. And what's more, if they want to think the Wog side's better, they're on the Wog side. It doesn't mean anything to them. And that's how it was. They were all different nationalities and different languages, but they all, you know, fitted in together and were lovely.
And what did you, what was your, like, what did you bring to the school yourself? Like, the school had been running, obviously, like, there'd been the big McMahon before you and Diana. And so what did you feel that you brought to the school? What how did you shape it?
I don't know. Joy Belt was in the school at the time, and she, as you know, is marvellous. And she was my assistant until she moved out. A fantastic support, much loved, and in her element there in the school, loving the kids, knowing them all, funny as can be, great educator. Programs she'd do, you know, teachers, poor things, have to do these programs and write up everything. She didn't have room in her program book. She'd be putting extensions on. That she was so efficient and lovely. Anyway, she moved out after a couple of years. One of the things that, well, we always tried to make it a loving place, and the teachers were on that line too. So we had to be careful to get teachers that were caring people as well as highly qualified. And very generous teachers they were. So the children went through there well educated. They could, they had the basics, and that's what we stressed. But also very open to anything. I know computers came on the scene while I was there. And we obtained one computer. The teachers were terrified. You know, nobody knew anything about computers. And we got one. It was in the office. And no teacher would take it on. Marg Connor, who by then had become the assistant principal, said, "We've got to do this. This is the future. I'll do it." She was the assistant. So she went to the courses and took on the computer. And I know the parents wanted us to fill the place up with computers. And I said, it's useless doing it now. We've got to put our money into training first. The teachers have all got to be trained. No, they wanted computers in the classrooms. They wanted, this school's got computers in every classroom. And I said, I know of one school, they said the computers are sitting on the shelves in the classroom because the teachers don't know what to do with them. So I just stood up and said, no, we're going to put the money first into training and then we'll get the computers, which we did. And David Harpley, who's a miracle of a man, look, we had the best out there. He could do anything in the school. He'd set an alarm system like you wouldn't believe. Then with lights that came on at the same time, because we were always getting broken into, that stopped it, I can tell you. And but he installed them in the second half of the library, and we got a great big one that the children could walk on the thing, and it had all come up for the class, on the, and they'd all have turns. Then I'd spent a lot of time going through all the, you know, advertisements you get to get little programs that would help them. And I know Margaret Connor said she used to take the ones that needed special help. She said you can see them learning. Programs that they'd have might be for maths. What's 1 and 4?
6.
No, so try again. This is coming on the screen. And another couple of goes, then I get it, get the right answer. Hooray, you got it. Well, she said you can put a child who will not stay in a desk for 10 minutes and you'll drag them away when the bell rings. She said you can see them learning. So that was one thing that was introduced because it was just topical that happened at that time. But I also tried to get more help with special education. And we did. We had one day, and I think we ended up with 3 days because there were so many and so much to be done with all the different languages as well as everything else, children, that, that you know, they just didn't get off to the right start and it was hard for them to learn. But so they, you know, every child was catered for, every teacher knew every child and knew what class and what group to put them in. And sometimes I got into trouble. They'd say, oh, that's dreaming. But would it all been thought out to put every child where they'd have enough challenge and enough support to get on? That was our philosophy anyway. And it was a great place.
how was it social? How important was the social elements in this? Like, did you? Was the Catholic Club a place where you?
Oh, were Catholic Club was fantastic. They were always giving us things, and we'd have a you know, annual event either over in the hall or sometimes at the Catholic Club. But they were always so generous. They'd give us, if we wanted anything, they'd come up with it. Lovely fathers of the children in the school very often were running it. No, they were, and we could go over there for meals if we wanted to. It was so inexpensive to buy meals. If they saw us and knew us, they wouldn't charge at all, but we didn't like doing that. But it was such a little bit. And we'd have, you know, functions there from the school. No, the Catholic Club. And the Catholic Club did so much for the district all around. They'd send this bus around to get the old people, to bring them into housing. And one lady that we knew, she was an elderly lady on her own, she got all her supply of meat and vegetables from winning at housing in this Catholic Club. That's how it was, you know. They were just fantastic. And one thing after another, they kept extending, but they kept on providing things for the youth. I believe they've got a skating rink out there. They had all the games that they used to go out to play, basketball and all the rest of it. No, that's a good place and a good thing out there, I think.
Mm. So was there a priest at the school?
Oh, well, you know we had Father Muldoon.
Yeah. I can't remember when he died.
Oh, he was a dream. But he did. He got, you know, just beyond it, and he went up to Kerevere Park. Then we had John Lankley for a while as administrator. He was fantastic, but he was just the administrator till they got a priest. Then we got Father Vince Finnegan. Well, he wasn't a priest that could cope with children. He's died since. So that was a very difficult time. And Joe Higgins, who was not long there when I left, and he was good. So, but he's moved on now too.
So for you as a person, how did you grow? Like, what did Green Valley give you? Because there was obviously an exchange, isn't it?
To some extent. Absolutely. Oh, I don't know. It certainly, I don't know how you'd measure or explain what it gave me, but it certainly, it was just, I felt a privilege to be there, and I treasure that time that I spent there. Because as a human being, it was such a good place to be. You were with real people, with great values. I keep saying there also you had every kind of thing going on. You know, you'd have kids in the school breaking into the school and this kind of thing, and ones who'd been at the school breaking into the school. But, you know, it didn't matter. there was so much goodness and so much reality that I think it was an education in real life that it showed up the goodness and the humanness of human nature, and you could, the lovable, you know, not so good.
I suppose it was so honest and open.
Absolutely, right? Yes.
And what are those spiritual values that often communities lack these days? Oh, I'm not trying to get into it,
yeah.
But, you know, it was a spiritual community.
Do you mean the convent or the whole community?
The whole community.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And even if they didn't have spirituality as such, they had goodness. And I mean, spirituality is something you've got to be, it's part of you, and it comes out in goodness. And they mightn't have had a lot of faith instruction or a lot of faith, you know, in their lives, but they had goodness that faith came out of it somehow. It was
Maybe they didn't have the consciousness.
Yes,
the conscious,
they weren't
part
aware
of contact,
yes.
But
yes.
They were, in fact, actually.
Yes. Good people.
How does that happen, I wonder? You know, like, it's an interesting thing to that natural goodness.
Yes, yes.
Versus spirituality.
Yes.
It's difficult.
Well, everybody has a spirituality, but they don't always have guidance. And in faith, they don't always have a lot of knowledge. But goodness is everybody's right to choose. And in their lives, there was so much goodness and generosity and just lovely people that it was a pleasure to be around. Mm.
So your life leaving, you had a year of spiritual reflection
before I came there.
Do you think that put you in good stead?
Oh, it was a wonderful year because we had the, it was called Assumption, and it was a 9-month course, at least 9 months, and we had the cream of the lecturers from the universities, Catholic University, the religious orders. We had wonderful lecturers, top men in their field. But we didn't have to do assignments and things like that that made it an academic thing. It was just to attend and take in. Well, I took more notes and kept the notes from that year that I never did for all my other years of study. Because I'd get an assignment done and bang went the notes and that was that one off. But with this, you could treasure it. It was all so beautiful. It was all the Gospels and, you know, beautiful lectures. So that was a very enriching year, I found. And that's where I started off then after that at St. Therese.
You would have been well placed to step in, into St. Therese.
Yeah.
What were your first impressions of the community, did you?
At St. Therese? Well, I'll tell you this. At the school where I was, at Sacré Cœur, on breakup day, say the end of the year, probably, or even the end of the holiday, when the holidays came, a half an hour after the bell had gone, there was nobody on the premises, not even the teachers. They'd all gone home, holidays, hooray. Okay, well, the first time holidays came, I was in my classroom. I always had to clean up. And at that stage, we cleaned our own floors. We eventually got somebody to do that. So I hoovered the classroom, cleaned the blackboard, tidied up, gathered my things, walked through to the convent. And as I walked across, I thought I heard music and noise or something coming from the staff room area. Anyhow, I kept going. And then we had tea. And we just finished tea when the doorbell rang. And I went, and there was Carmel Dwyer with a castanet with bells on it, you know, shaking it, and Joe Camilleri, the curate, and Carmel said, come on, over you come, you've got to join us over here, join us for tea. I said, I've had my tea, doesn't matter, come on, over you come. So over I went. Well, the music was going, they weren't all there because the young ones had gone to get Chinese to eat. They were dancing, the music was going, they were dancing on the table. Because the four big tables got together. So Carmel dragged me up, had to get off my shoes, and there I was in no time dancing on the table. They were there until about 11 o'clock, you know, just enjoying each other's company and having fun. Michelle Allsbrook said she's got a picture of me dancing on the table. I can't get it back for her, so there it is. But that was the difference. You see, they enjoyed each other's company. And that's how it was. It was a family kind of a thing. And I'll tell you, that happened, you know, they'd always be there after, instead of going home and forgetting school and that's the end of it. No, they enjoyed celebrating together. And as I say, they'd go home at about 11 o'clock. Even if I'd, you know, knock out a bit before that, I'd hear the car doors slamming. So that was St. Therese. It was like a family. And the children loved it too. I remember we produced a magazine for the 25 years. There was a big celebration. Jason Gatt, I don't know if you know. No, Jason. Oh, what's his name? Not Gatt. Jason. Oh, everybody knew Jason. He was born with a tooth. Lovely fellow. He's at the education department in Broken Bay now, but he was the editor for the magazine that we produced for the 25 years, and one write-up was from a little girl, or she was a lady then, but they were able to write back any memories they had, and she said, little St. Therese School, it was like walking into your own home, and I thought that was the biggest compliment that the place could have had. From one of the children, past pupil. I don't know what it was like for you. You were there. I don't know if you resonate with this.
Absolutely. It was extraordinary. Yeah. Why am I doing this?
Yeah,
very extraordinary. Unbelievable. The nuns were unbelievable.
Well, look at the motto, simply love. Or really, Father Muldoon expect us as a simple love, you know, like Saint Therese, just a simple love, and nothing high and mighty or floating, but love says it all. So, if that's the motto that carries on.
And how are you today? Where are you? We're going to wind up.
Not yet. No, we're all right. Not just yet. A few more minutes.
I know. So leaving St. Therese would have been sad.
Oh, yes, it was terribly sad. I had to retire. And my provincial... used to get cheesed off with people who would complain about where they had to go or what they had to do, because I thought, if you've entered, you do what you're told. And if you can do a thing, you should do it. So that was here, as I was all ready to do anything and do it. And she said... they need somebody in the boarding school. Adolescent girls that I'd never had to do anything with, my life, 150 of them. I said, no, I couldn't possibly. And then I thought, oh, here I am, aren't I a nice one? Me, I'll do anything, you should do anything. So I got back and said, well, okay. I don't know the slightest thing about running a boarding school, and I don't know the slightest thing about adolescent girls. I've only from hearsay. But the principal up there was David Manning, and he'd been there a long time, a wonderful man. And he wrote to me and he said, I will look after you. And didn't he look after me? Because I didn't have a clue the things they would be up to. He knew exactly which way they were going to jump, and he knew exactly what to do with them, and he'd cope with the parents. And well, he did it all, and I could go to his office any hour of the day or night. He used to work there at night because his wife had died. He'd work up there in the office very often. And it was as if he was just waiting to help me with whatever I needed or any situation that they'd been up to. So I just had a ball. They were so funny. I used to say it's a laugh or cry a minute, and they would ask how I got on. But really, they're lovely girls. So that's where I went from there. And I was there until I was plucked by the hair of my head to come down here and be with the elderly sisters. So I went from corridors where I looked out going around a corner in case I was skittled, to look out in case I skittled somebody coming around a corner here. But there you are.
Where is here? Can we just...
Kalaminda, where our old sisters are, and I was called the community leader, but I didn't have anything to do with running the hostel because servant, the manager does that. So I was just there for the sisters, all their medical appointments and anything that they wanted, and I'm still doing that now that they're getting around the four corners of the globe.
This is closing. So what's happening?
Nobody knows yet. It'll probably be a while before they know.
What does that mean for you?
That means I don't know either. But I'll be here until they decide. And I'm getting another sister. Kath Ragg is coming up to help me. And we'll look after the sisters that are out in the four or five different places.
So you'll be like visiting?
Oh, well, we'll be looking
around.
After, yes, yes, and taking them to all their appointments and buying all the things that they need and everything like that. And it'll be quite busy because it's very busy already.
So you look in extraordinary condition. You know, a lot of you look really well.
Well, we're well looked after. We really are. We're spoiled, I think.
So prayer pays off.
Yes, absolutely, because, you know, if you know the Lord's looking after everything, and he does every little thing, it takes a lot of burden off it, even if it's hard, you know.
How do you... Look, I understand, you know, I practice that to the best of my ability.
We all do, don't worry.
And that fear that creeps in. Yeah. But sometimes it is, for me, that simple reminder that, and that's why, you know, if God's taking care of it, I just need to do
absolutely.
What I've got to do.
Yeah, that's right. In a spiritual that's all you way. Can do. That's all you can do. You don't see ahead. Just do what you think is right. That's all. And the Lord said it often enough. If you really read the scriptures, some of the things... You know, the hairs of your head are all counted. I mean, How more caring, you know, in a knowledgeable way can that be? So that's the care we've got. I am with you always, even to the end of the world. You know, these kinds of things, if you take them literally, it can make your life a lot more, oh, peaceful, I suppose, because things don't always go your way. I mean, the cross is always, that's the way, but there's a strength through it, hopefully. I'm prepared to practice what I preach.
Walk the walk, we call
it. Yes, that's right, yeah.
So God is within.
Yes, with, yeah.
What is God?
I say who, but
who?
Yes.
Who is God?
Yeah. Well, God is God, three persons. Well, it's God is a mystery, but he showed us what he's like in Jesus. Sometimes the hymns the children sang, especially Kerry Landry's, had so much theology in them. Jesus came to show us what God is like, what God is like. You know, Jesus came to show us the Father's will. These little kids singing it. And if that goes into their minds for life, well, they've got something to guide them. And another one about friends are like flowers. I love the song. Friends are like flowers, beautiful flowers. Friends are like flowers in the garden of life. Are you a daisy? Are you a rose? Are you a dandelion? You be what you are, and I'll be what I am, and we will be friends in the garden of life. Isn't that beautiful? For little children from every nationality you could think of, you know. So, here you go.
I remember God is dwelling in my heart.
Yes, he and I are one. Yes, that's a beautiful one too. And if these things can come back to you, you know, sometimes just to be singing them, well, it's reality, and it's because the unseen can be more real than the seen. And in the Aboriginals world, that was the case. They respected the trees. They respected nature. They didn't harm things. Oh, you know, well, that's just their culture, which is. But I think we might have to call it a day.